Let's humble our hearts before Almighty Yahweh. Father in heaven, you are so grand and so majestic. And we are so honored to come before you on your Sabbath day, to serve you, to think on you, to think on your word, to delve into it, so that the words you have put there for us will benefit us not only now, but way into the future. We thank you, Almighty Yahweh, that you have placed your prophets, your writers, your son into that word, that we can look at their examples and we can look at the issues they faced, and we can say, you know what? It's not so bad. They got through it. So will we. For we know, Almighty Yahweh, that not everyone is for the truth in this world. We know that the adversary would like nothing more than for us to just fold up and go home. Now we know, Almighty Yahweh, that you have called us out. You have given us some understanding that you want us to share with the world. And this we will do as long as we can. And so we thank you, Almighty Yahweh. We praise you for bringing many to come to the knowledge of truth. We thank you for many who are sincerely seeking, that we might be a help to them. And we ask for your guidance now in this service and all that we do and say. In Yahshua's name, hallelujah. And you may be seated. President Reagan's advice to the Russian president, Mikhail Gorbachev, was the now famous phrase, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall." A wall that had divided Berlin since 1961. A wall that had meant countless heartache, difficulties, and trials for the people of Germany there in the capital city. A wall such as that is meant either to keep something out or to keep something in. You know, there are many walls to the truth as well that we find constantly in our walk. They have the same effect, to keep tradition in and to keep the truth out, to keep the status quo going and to keep any change from happening. We here have a great opportunity to bring Bible truth back to the world that has been deprived of it for nearly 2,000 years. To those who have a longing for the truth and who want to make certain that their calling and election are sure. But the problem is, the way of truth is not easy and it's not painless. Yahshua said as much. Despite what the TV evangelist might say, Yahshua tells us the way is narrow, the walk is difficult. But it's also very rewarding for those who persevere. And that's what I want to talk about today, getting through those obstacles and persevering. The way of the word, because it's not easy, has many lessons for us when we learn how to navigate all the walls that we have to get through. If it were easy, as many teach, then the way would not be narrow. It'd be a 10-lane highway, smooth as silk, straight as an arrow, all downhill, no effort on it. Just go with the flow. No curves, no difficulties, no bumps. And many would be on it. Keeping the precepts of Scripture and following the wishes of Almighty Yahweh takes a special kind of person. That's why Yahweh's chosen you. He sees the specialness in you. He knows that he can use you if you will simply open up and follow him. The Bible refers to those who persevere as the chosen. He calls those he wants. He chooses those who make the grade. The chosen will be those who have overcome the myriad of obstacles in their walk and still remain true to the word. They're special. They really are special. Many stumbling blocks must be surmounted in order to continue successfully living in this world and then, more importantly, living for Yahweh. This world does not have much for the truth, as we all know. We hear about these issues all the time and the battle that we ourselves have had to face. And just when you think you've experienced it all, you get blindsided with some new challenge in your walk with Messiah. We know that when the feasts come around, we especially have to face temporary walls thrown up by the adversary who wants nothing more than to keep us from obeying Yahweh and come to his feasts. So we have people saying, I got financial problems. I can't make it. The car broke down. I can't make it. I'm getting sick. I don't think I'll make it. Some people just say, I got too much to do at work. I can't make it. Little walls. These are little walls. They don't amount to anything. Every one of them can be overcome for those that have a desire to go to serve Yahweh. This way of truth we're in has many trials and sometimes tribulations. It's not a walk in the park, as we all know, and the closer you get to the truth, the more you're going to face opposition, the greater the challenge. Yahweh promised that his people would have tribulation. Yahshua told his disciples in John 16:33, these things have I spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you shall have tribulation. Now this counters all those messages we hear about how easy it is, just, you know, it's all health, wealth, and prosperity. Just give your heart to him and it's smooth sailing. He says, in the world you're going to have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. It takes a person with the right stuff to persevere, and Yahshua had the right stuff. He is our example. Oftentimes the road is filled with potholes, twists, turns, bumps, numerous obstacles, and sometimes you want to say, is it worth it? Of course it's worth it. We just have to get through it. There's even walls to conquer. And it was meant this way. Overcoming opposition helps to develop within us the strength, the stamina, and the character that Yahweh is looking for. We have to overcome. We learn long-suffering that way. James 1:3 tells us, knowing this, that the trying of your faith, it does try your faith at times, works patience. But let patience have her perfect work. I love that. Patience has a perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. If we're following Yahshua, why should it be no different from what he had to go through? Some of the trials and difficulties he had to go through. Why should it be any different? If we're in line for the prize, we need to make our calling and election sure. We might have got to make sure that, yes, I'm going to stick with it all the way. I don't care, come what may. And the only way to determine our constitution is through real-life school of hard knocks. It's the only way. Opposing forces and pressures are there in order to build and refine us in our walk. A lady called recently and said, why does Yahweh allow crisis in life? Why does he allow that if I'm following him? And I explained that it was humanity that rejected Yahweh in the first place. Don't blame him. Never blame him for problems and trials. They have a purpose. Man suffers when he kicks Yahweh out of his life. That's just the way it is. If he can't see that, then he keeps getting problems, trials, difficulties, until he learns to quit rebelling. Yahweh's chosen it this way. And he allows trials for believers as well, because that helps build character and stamina and get you ready for the bigger ones. The ones we face now are nothing. Think what Yahshua went through. It builds loyalty to Yahweh and the right stuff. Peter wrote in 1 Peter 1:7 to 9 that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perishes, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise. How about that? And honor and glory at the appearing of Yahshua the Messiah. See, it's all for a purpose, and it happens, it all comes together when Yahshua returns. Whom having not seen, you love, in whom, though now you see him not, yet believing you rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. One day it's just going to all be worthwhile when you see the results. Sometimes we just can't see the results. We have myopic vision. We see close hand. We can't see far out. That's why he gives us his word, to explain this to us. Look, there's a reason for it. Don't give up. Hang in there. You rejoice with joy unspeakable, full of glory, receiving the end. That's goal. That's telos. That's not the end of the law, as they say. Same word, but it's the end or the goal, the purpose of your life, you see. Telos, the purpose of your faith, even the salvation of your souls. It takes discipline. Hey, did you know that discipline is the same, comes from the same root as disciple? We know that disciple means a learner. So from discipline, we learn. You have to suffer some discipline to learn. It's punishment meant to correct or train. It's a systematic method, the dictionary says, to obtain obedience. So that's what we're doing when we're disciplined. We're learning to obey. We're learning. We're being trained for something greater. You know, when a foundry hardens steel, maybe you picked up a tool or a hammer. I know guys probably, but not, maybe not the ladies. Pick up a tool and a hammer, it says drop forged on it. Ever notice that? What does that mean? Drop forged. Well, in the foundry, when they harden steel, they pound on it. We know that blacksmiths did that the ancient way. You know, they took the hammer and whack, 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 and the sparks flew, and it was hot and all that. They were hardening that steel, horseshoes or whatever they're making, plowshares, I don't know. But that's how they did it. When you pound it, it increases the strength of the metal, aligning and stretching the grain structure so that's stronger than, you know, pot metal or some kind of machined metal. When the believer gets pounded, he should begin becoming stronger. Yahweh needs strong and determined believers, followers, not milquetoast believers. Peter says all the trials that a believer faces will be worth it when Yahshua comes to bring his rewards. We won't get anywhere by shrinking back when faced with adversity. You see, complications have a purpose. And until an issue is brought to a crisis, we just float along with the status quo. We don't make any changes because we don't necessarily have to at that point. But when it comes to a crisis, then we kick it in gear. Then we start looking closely at our lives and our situation, and that's why ministers go to hospitals, because people start assessing their lives and thinking about themselves and their situation. And, of course, basically to help them, too, get through it. But prison ministries do the same. You get in prison, you got a lot to think about. And you have a lot of time to think about it. We get letters. We get many letters from prisoners as we get regular mail. Every day, prisoners write. They want information. They want a Bible. They want help. They want some kind of counseling, whatever. Because they've got in a situation where they're assessing themselves, time to stop and think, stop to reassess, and look at themselves in a different light. That's the way we are. We don't do much until we have to do something. There are two basic types of religious people: the Bible hobbyist and the serious believer. The hobbyist dabbles in this belief and that one. He attends this church group and then that one. He's like a big balloon just floating all over the place. Blown here and blow there over the religious landscape. Never landing to settle down and set roots in somewhere by helping others, pulling together. His life is pretty much just a waste of time in many ways. The serious believer, on the other hand, is deeply convinced by what he knows, what he's learned, and he seeks to live by it. He wants to be grounded in the truth. And then he wants to get the truth to others. And he knows that the only way that's going to happen is if he pulls together with others to make it happen. Because he can't do it on his own. Nobody can. We all have to have help to get the word out. And so he works and supports the efforts of fellow believers and called to this same following. And because of the nature of his intensity, sometimes he faces the greatest resistance as he finds the truth in the Word. You know, it's axiomatic that the less dedicated you are to Yahweh, the less resistance you're going to find in life. So what does that mean? What does that lead to? It means less dedication for most people. Why put up with stuff if you don't have to? Just go along with it. The lukewarm believer leads a life of least resistance and lowest impact. And if they remain lukewarm, if they don't change, they will never make a meaningful impact anywhere. They'll never make a mark for Yahweh's truth, and they'll likely never have those kingdom rewards promised to the faithful. Yahweh said he'll spew the lukewarm out of his mouth. He doesn't want that kind of attitude. He wants people that get in there and work, get in there and do, get in there with zeal. The most rewarding jobs, the most high-paying jobs, are those that require something of people. You know, as we all work in the workaday world and our job, we hear from people say, "Man, I wish I made that kind of money that the manager makes, or, you know, the owner makes. He makes big money. I'm making nothing." Guess what? The guy has to earn it. He has a lot of more responsibility. He's going to age faster than you, believe it or not. Because he's got to deal with the problems that you don't. You go in there, you punch the time clock, you do your work, and you go home. That's it. This guy probably is facing problems and issues he thinks about all night long, wakes up in night sweats worrying about it. That's why he's paid better. The same thing with the believer. The same thing. The more dedicated you are, the more responsibility you're going to have. But the rewards are so much greater. Looking back when you started out on the truth, what were the most common obstacles you faced? Do you remember? Think back. For some of us, it's thinking way back. But if you got a good memory, what were some of the issues that caused you the most difficulty when you realized you had to do something about the truth you were learning? You had to start living it, not just learning it. You had to do something with it. Who or what gave you the most aggravation and frustration in your new walk? Who was the most resistant when they found out you're going the way of truth? Who didn't like it the most? Who was the most objectionable when it came to your Sabbath keeping and feast observance? Employers, school administrators probably figure in, but they were secondary. No doubt it was spouse and family, who first on the list presented a much bigger challenge. And today I want to discuss the most common hurdles that stand in the way of someone coming into the truth. The way of the true worshiper, keeping to the faith once delivered. Well, these aren't the only impediments, but I'm going to hit the major ones, the ones that most people face. Many of these live at the root of Yahshua's seed sower parable. Remember that? Sowing seeds and starts to grow, but it got choked out. Starts to grow, but no rain. Starts to grow, but it's on rocks and can't reach down. These are all metaphors for something serious happening in his life spiritually. These are obstacles he's facing. These are walls that are going up to his truth, to his walk in the truth. This memorable parable spoke about the many walls of the newly interested to either successfully overcome and grow spiritually or to give up and go back to the world. Today I want to focus on specific walls. So, brother and sister believer, I encourage you today to tear down that wall. I hope to give us some tools that you can use as we confront these obstacles common to every believer, every truth seeker. First and greatest, I have to say, maybe not greatest, but the most widespread is tradition. Tradition. Tradition is a powerful force. Whether the inhibiting of church tradition or family tradition, many just can't break free and follow the correct teachings. Their growth is stunted or doesn't exist at all, held down by the force of habit, calcified habit in their life and in their family. Habits are hard to break. They work overtly and they work covertly. It's summed up in the phrase, "Well, that's the way I've always believed." Think about that for a minute. That attitude leads only to one conclusion. Custom, then, is my yardstick. Custom. Whatever I've done in the past is how I'm going to gauge the future. It's the test of authenticity by which most people evaluate almost anything new. They look back on their experience and compare it with what they know. And that only makes common sense, but there's a danger in that, because you've got to make sure that experience is correct if you're going to measure it against something new. And therein lies the rub. Does that make sense? Well, it doesn't make sense if it's not accurate. What makes your present beliefs so right? How do you know that what you've believed all your life is the truth, is accurate? How do you know that? Have you proved it? Most people don't. The Bible is the most misunderstood and least read book and most popular book, on the other hand, in the world, and people never read it. They don't know. They go to their minister, and he keeps them back in tradition again. So they never get anywhere. They're high-centered. The wheels are spinning and going nowhere. Is it correct enough to be able to measure other things by? Some have a time calling on the name of Yahweh and Yahshua when they learn it. For me, letting go of the titles took a little effort when I first learned it. But then it was the force of 17 years of habit. For some people, it's a lot longer. It's 50 years of habit, 60 years of habit. And it took me a while. I had to overcome. I had to realize, look, he has a name and he wants me to call him on him. For most, it's decades of using substitutes. But once you break free and start calling on the one you worship by his revealed personal name, it all starts to make sense. You can say so long to tradition, and you don't want to look back. If tradition had won out, if tradition is the determining factor, think about this. Would Alexander Graham Bell ever had success with his telephone? Because it had nothing in common with the Pony Express, right? Why don't we just keep with the Pony Express? That was what tradition was, even though it didn't last very long. It was only like 3 or 4 years, but there it was. Or the telegraph. Why don't we just stick with the telegraph? Why mess with the telephone? Because we want to go back to tradition. That's got to be the right way, right? Regardless, the power of traditional belief and habit present a serious wall of opposition when it comes to accepting new teaching. Religious teaching and tradition sticks like epoxy to whatever it adheres to. It can be tradition as taught by the word, and in that case, it's advantageous and good, or man-made church traditions, which nearly always run counter to the truth. It is those man-made tenets that are so difficult to break, so the most popular and problematic for people. Yahshua faced this wall opposition in his debate with those firmly entrenched religious leaders of his day. For them, tradition trumped the command of Yahweh itself. Their Talmud would become the Talmud. Their oral traditions took precedence over the scriptures. Their practices, their man-made practices, were first and foremost the thing that they adhered to, above all. For them, tradition was everything. Matthew 15:6, Yahshua said, "For thus have you made the commandment of Elohim of none effect by your tradition, you hypocrites. Well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, this people draws nigh unto me with their mouth and honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." Why? Because they're teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. In Mark 7:9, he said further, "Full well you reject the commandment of Elohim that you may keep your own tradition." Where was the truth? It wasn't there. You know, Judaism had so many entrenched traditions, even in his day, and it's gotten even more in our day, because you know how we pile on. That's the tendency of human beings, to make more and more and more. That Paul had brought something different. And he was seen as a deviation. He was seen as some kind of cult. And it was these calcified beliefs that they were relying on, these calcified traditions. Have you ever presented an unfamiliar teaching to someone like, say, the heir of the immortal soul doctrine? And they dismiss it by saying, well, I'm Baptist. I'm Roman Catholic. As if, well, that answers that. That comeback lies at the heart of the problem with tradition. It closes the mind to new and proper understanding. What does the Bible say? I don't really care what you believed. Let's go to the scriptures. Let's go to the videotape. Let's find out what it says. But that attitude closes the mind to new and proper understanding. It says, I'm satisfied accepting what I've already known, I've already accepted, and I've already been taught, so don't confuse me with anything new. Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Tradition is a powerful force against the truth. It's the first wall of separation that we typically face. An adjoining wall is popular church doctrine, which is related. I say popular for a reason. As soon as a doctrine or a tenet becomes popular, as soon as it gets widespread acceptance, wide popularity, it immediately is suspect. Very few biblical truths are popular. Very few. Look at the Sabbath. How many people keep the true Sabbath today? And yet it's clear as a bell in the scriptures. There's even a commandment for it. Fourth commandment. And they'll argue against it. Precious few will accept biblical truths. And that in itself tells me there's something to them. There's some truth to them. And that is why Yash referred to his called out ones as a small circle of believers. Luke 12:32, he says, fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. You see, they're small, they adhere to the truth, and their rewards are the kingdom. Look at the outcome. They may be small, so what? Look at the outcome. Now he was not after the masses, or he'd call the whole world. He's not calling the whole world. He says, many are called. He doesn't say all are called. And then few are chosen. Why doesn't he choose many? That's the idea you hear today. Everybody, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of life he lived. At the funeral, he's up in heaven. Doesn't matter. Everybody goes there. Really? Show me that in the scripture. Our biggest struggles are against church doctrine that doesn't square with scripture, because that's their reference point. The tradition that they believed in. The majority of accepted church teachings today had their roots in the turmoil, the centuries from 100 to 450. And if you think that everything was just a smooth transition from the apostles, Yahshua and the apostles, on into the new era, the New Testament, you've got another thing coming. Because there was nothing but trials, fightings, murders. When they developed these doctrines in the Roman Empire through Constantine, it was a lot of infighting, a lot. I mean, this went on for centuries. You think that the Trinity just happened? It's not in the scriptures. It had to develop, and boy, there were a lot of opposition to it. Today, it's the test stone. It's the touchstone. It's, if you don't believe in the Trinity, you're not a Bible believer. And yet, if you look back in history, that's not the case. They didn't teach it in the New Testament. It's not even, the word isn't even the Bible. But people like Athanasius and so forth came along, and here we are. He developed a triad, and there we go. The majority of accepted church teachings came from this turmoil in the first 400 years. And they were formed and shaped by a Roman church that compromised with their pagan religions they're trying to embrace. And they were solidified after much fighting and bloodshed, and enforced by imperial decree. And they weren't doing anything more, or should say anything less, than we see and we hear about with the spread of Islam. You didn't believe it? You're banished or you're dead. This happened. Just think of the Inquisitions and the horrible things they did, even up into the Spanish Inquisition. Consider that these church teachings have been universally taught and believed for over 16 centuries, 1,600 years. And you don't think we have a battle on our hands It's no wonder they're an issue for the truth seeker today. Such teachings are so calcified they can only be abandoned after studying of the truth. And most people today don't have the knowledge or just won't study in order to test them. It's too much work. I don't understand the Bible anyway. I might as well just give up. Well, it's not too much work. If Yahweh didn't give it to us to learn, to study by, and to pattern our lives by, then what was the point of giving it to us? Many fear what they might find if they do. And so they go back again to the vice grip of tradition and basically go nowhere. Major Christian doctrines today are fundamentally just Catholic doctrines. Catholic beliefs that have held sway 1,600 years. Germinated in the Roman Church. And they've been common fare for so long that they become the gold standard against which all doctrines are measured. Doesn't matter if it's in the Bible. And they've got that one covered too, because they say that they were given the keys to the kingdom through Peter, and that means we have the right to even deviate from the Bible. So what are you going to do? When somebody doesn't have the same... it's hard. Certain religious groups knock on your door. It's hard to discuss things with them when they got their own Bible that they go by. You know what I'm talking about. You have to have a common foundation to go from, or you're not going to go anywhere. Well, these people, when they have their own Bible, their own scriptures, their own standard, I'll just say, well, have a good one, because we don't have anything in common. If you don't believe that the Father, Son, and Spirit are three beings, all equal individuals, you're considered a heretic. Never mind that Yahshua said that his Father is greater than I, he's greater than all. They can't be co-equal. Never mind that the Trinity teaching is completely absent from both Old and New Testaments. Never mind that the earliest church fathers themselves saw the Spirit as a force and less of a person. Yeah, that's true. They didn't believe it either. It took a lot of wrangling, a lot of infighting. Forget the fact that the pagan religions absorbed by the Roman Empire all had multiple deities, which the triune deity teaching fits the same pattern. Tradition, no matter what brand, is a wall that needs to be penetrated for what it is. Well, the next wall that hinders someone coming into the truth, to a right understanding, is the natural dislike and fear of change. You've all had it. You've all seen it. Most people have that natural aversion to change. Tradition fits into this as well. But the unknowns surrounding change cause many to back away from it. For many, change means loss of control. Change feels like an assault on a person's sense of control over his life. We want things to be static because we're comfortable with it that way. That's the way we know. That's the way we've gone accustomed to. No risks, no danger, and it's where we feel most protected. Sometimes change involves a significant loss, and we don't like that. When we invest ourselves emotionally in anything, it becomes harder to change. And believe me, when it comes to religion, that's one of the tightest bonds, maybe other than family bonds, that you're going to have emotionally. The earlier we made the investment and the longer we had it, the more difficult it is to give up. I remember my dad's used to say, it's so much easier to learn something without the baggage than to have to relearn through years and years of false baggage. And change also causes uncertainty. This is related to the loss of control we get with change. We like knowing what's going to happen next. We naturally fear what we don't know. Change pulls us out of our comfort zone. We're beings of habit. Routines become knee-jerk and automatic. But change jolts us into consciousness, sometimes in uncomfortable ways. We have to start looking at things that we really never looked at before. And that's troubling for many. Change affects our pride. We don't like to admit we were wrong. Change often leads to conflict. You know, like tossing a pebble into a pond, and the concentric circles get bigger and bigger and bigger and start affecting more and more and more. The ripples disrupt other people, and they start to push back. Family and friends may react negatively against a new teaching one has accepted. And that's a powerful obstacle for many people. Change sometimes feels like failure. It's not just that my beliefs belong to me. I actually belong to my beliefs. So to suggest I change my beliefs is like a personal attack on me. That I've been wrong all these years. How can I be wrong? I don't like to be wrong. The Bible study, I guess Brother Mike talked about the Japanese. They hate to make a mistake. They hate it. And so some of them can't even handle it. It says that I'm inadequate, so I have to change. And that takes some humility, and most humility is difficult. It's very difficult. Man, by his own nature, is very prideful. He doesn't like to be humbled. And most people like to fit in with the crowd. That's the other issue. It's why they follow the latest hairstyles, the latest clothing styles. They don't want to stand out as being different and risk being rejected, so they fall in with, the custom. And this leads to another wall we face, which is the fear of being exclusive. I'll be different if I believe that. I'll be different. I'll be looked on as different if I leave the beaten path. Some people relish the idea. Some people just have that nature, They're nonconformists. They just have that kind of constitution that says, I'm an individual and I don't follow the crowd, and especially when that crowd is wrong. I think we find more of that characteristic in the people Yahweh chose in the Bible. They were individuals. They had to be. Those prophets had to be able to stand up and out against even the rulership of the nation. I was a little bit that way too, I have to confess. In my teen years, I was a nonconformist in the late 1960s hippie trend with its love of drugs, immorality, and rebellion against authority. And I alone with others saw that what it was doing to the culture, what it was doing trying to do away with the Bible, and I pushed back. I think most believers who take an active stand are that way. We're all that way in most regards. We don't like to see people following error. But there are also those who are being pulled along behind them that secretly don't like being different. They don't like being on the front lines, so they hold back. In 2 Timothy 4:10, Paul mentions a chap named Demas who forsook Paul because he liked this present world more. And so he left for the attractions of the big city of Thessalonica with its 200,000 population. Was Joshua conformist to the religious establishment, or was he opposed to the status quo? Well, we know the answer to that. At every turn, he battled the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who had set up their own basically puppet religion that continues down today through rabbinical Judaism, based on their man-made tenets and decrees. Joshua and his apostles were exclusive, and they didn't care. They knew they had to be that way because the truth was distinctive. It wasn't run-of-the-mill. So to follow it, you had to be not run-of-the-mill. They cared about teaching the truth as their first focus, and they let the chips fall where they may. They didn't apologize for it. They didn't look out and test the weather, run a survey first, see what the people are thinking before I go out. Maybe I better watch it. People may not like it. No, they spoke the truth boldly and with conviction. And that in itself drew people to them. This guy must really believe it because look at him. Maybe there's something to it. Or why would he act like this? So whatever happened after that happened. They didn't accept it. Paul says, I move on to the next city. Shake the dust off my shoes and go on to the next one if they don't receive me. See, we can't be afraid of our own shadows when it comes to living Yahweh's teachings. He's watching, and we're not fooling him. At one of the early feasts, a man came who had a problem with his wife, who just was obsessed with Xmas. I mean, obsessed. She lived, ate, slept Xmas. I know. We happened to go by on the way back to Pennsylvania. We stopped at his house. Oh, my goodness, you ought to see that house. It was decorated like you wouldn't believe. He couldn't get her to see the light. She couldn't get past that. So he just accommodated it. And where is he today? You see, you got to stand for your faith. He chose to avoid the conflict, and it got him nowhere. Yahweh's people need backbone. They need to step up and make the necessary changes in their lives, or nothing will ever change. And that leads to another wall, which is probably the greatest obstacle. The family, particularly the unbelieving spouse. We hear about it all the time. How do I convince my wife? How do I convince my husband of the truth that I'm following? Yahshua said in Matthew 10:34, "Think not that I'm come to send peace on the earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I'm come," now listen to this, "I am come to set a man at variance against his father." People say he came with love and embracing everybody. What does he say? "Because I stand for a truth, it's going to cause friction. I'm putting a man against his father, the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law." Why? Because he doesn't call everybody at one time. He takes one of a family, two of a household. Typically. "And a man's foes shall be they of his own household." And believe me, that is the most substantiated phrase in the whole Bible, because we see it all the time. All the time. "He that loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me." In other words, he shrinks back. "Oh, they don't accept it. I guess I'll just do something else." The clear implication is that the believer must not defer to the unbeliever, whether it's in the world or in his family. Yahweh comes first, always. How do you make that work when a spouse is antagonistic? How do you make that work? In Ephesians 5:22, Yahweh tells wives to submit to their husbands. And that grates against the sensibilities of today's woman. Submit to a man? Do you realize how far the culture has gotten from the standard Yahweh designed? What is the prototype woman of 2013? I pulled this from a ministry website. Tell me if it doesn't ring true. What is the modern superwoman supposed to be? Maybe something like this. She works, builds her own career, demands equal pay, refuses to submit to her husband, demands equality with him in everything, has an affair or two and a divorce or two. She exercises her independence. She relies on her own resources, doesn't want her husband or children to threaten her personal goals, has her own bank account. She hires a maid or a cleaning service, eats out about 50% of the time with her family or without them, makes cold cereal and coffee, the standard breakfast for her family, quick frozen meals, usual dinner fare, or she calls Domino's Pizza, expects her husband to do his share of the housework. She is tanned, coiffured, aerobatized into bodybuilding shape, shops to keep up with the fashion trends, makes sure she can compete in the attention-getting contest, puts the kids in a daycare center, makes sure that each has an iPhone, a TV in his room, and an Xbox. She is opinionated, demanding, wants to be heard, eager to fulfill all of her personal goals. Doesn't this sound like what you see out there today? The people that have no clue? Let's compare that with Yahweh's ideal in Proverbs 31. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband does safely trust in her, so that she shall have no need of spoil. He shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant's ships. She brings her food from afar. Didn't get it from Domino's. She brings her food from afar. She rises also while it is yet night, still dark, and gives meat to her household, prepares the breakfast in the morning, and a portion to her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. Now, she's not a wimp. She knows the value of money, and she's out there for the good of the family, making wise decisions, financial decisions even. With the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard. She girds her loins with strength and strengthens her arms. I don't think that means at the gym either, because she's strengthening herself by the work she's doing. She perceives that her merchandise is good. She knows her stuff. She knows a bad deal from a good deal. She's smart. Her candle goes not out by night. She lays her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. She works. She works for the family. She works for the good. She stretches out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the needy. She has a heart. She's not just in it for herself. She's not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She prepares them for the things they're going to face out in the world. She makes herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. Her husband is known by the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. You know why he's known? One of the reasons is because of her. She makes fine linen and sells it and delivers girdles unto the merchant. She makes stuff to sell. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom. She's not just a babbler. What she says means something, and people listen. And in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looks well to the ways of her household. That's her responsibility, and she takes it seriously. And eats not the bread of idleness. Her children arise up and call her blessed. You know what? You want to know what a man and woman are? Look at the children. Look at their attitude toward them. That'll tell you all you need to know. Because they're living with them day in and day out. They know if there's phoniness in a parent, they can sense it just like that. And these children call her blessed. Her husband also, he praises her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excel them all. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that fears Yahweh, she shall be praised. How about that? She's got substance. Give her of the fruit of her hands and her own works. Praise her in the gates. I'll tell you what. What a contrast. What a contrast to what we see today. It's too bad that our culture, our economy is such that women have to go out and work. And many do. But, you know, family still needs to come first. Still has to be taken care of first. So what if you're married to prototype of the world, this 21st century woman or a husband who can't get on board with the truth, they're too caught up in themselves? What do you do? Well, it's going to take some prayer. It's going to take some patience. It's going to take some perseverance. And it's going to take some perspective. You're going to have to get into their mind and go from their perspective out if you're going to convince them. You have opportunities each day to do that, to make inroads with them. Just you have to recognize and take advantage of that. Be honest and forthright. And don't give ultimatums. So either do that or I'm going out. I won't be back till midnight. Don't give ultimatums. But in the spirit of love, show how your faith makes you a better spouse. I remember a woman, she's probably in her 80s, years ago, she's gone now. But that was her advice to women who come to her and say, how do I deal with my husband? It's a lot harder to deal that way than the other way around when a husband has an unbelieving wife. But when a wife has an unbelieving husband, she said, become the best wife you can. Show him that your faith makes you a better wife. Show him by while you live. What can he say? You know, you're going to win him over. Maybe not all the way. Maybe he's not called, but he's going to lean your direction. And he's going to let you, you know, practice your faith if you do that and not constantly fight and threaten. That's not going to get you anywhere. Remember Proverbs 15:1, a soft answer turns away wrath, but those grievous words stir up anger, resentment. You know, people have a knee-jerk reaction. You attack them, they're going to attack you back. That's the natural human. Now, the last wall in this resistance to the truth is non-believing relatives and friends. Here, I guess you can only lead by your example. They have to look to you and say, yeah, but you know, he's a very upright person. I have to respect him. That may be the only, you know, kudos you're going to get. He's very respectable. They may not understand. They may not agree. But that's okay. It's up to Yahweh anyway, right? You can't force somebody. He who's convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. You're not going to change them unless Yahweh moves in their life. But you can be the best example. Never be a hypocrite. They're going to throw that right back at you as the first opportunity. Oh, yeah, but look what you do on the Sabbath. You want me to keep it? Look what you do. If you live your faith, they're going to respect your stand whether they believe it or not. And being a good example may be the only impact you're ever going to have with unbelieving relatives. There is an important warning, however. Never let relatives or friends dictate how you live your faith. You stand strong. There again, they're going to look at you and say, well, you can't believe it that much. Look how you back down at the first opportunity. Look how you give in. Look how you compromise. Don't let them decide whether you'll keep the Sabbath because of their Saturday adventures or their to-do list that they want to draw you in. Never let them dictate whether you will attend Yahweh's commanded feasts. This is your life and your salvation. Stand up for it. Protect your walk. Make a statement by how you live. That's what most are going to read anyway. They may not even read the word. They're just going to say, oh, you're giving me a mumbo jumbo. You're going to try me, suck me into it. Live your life. Show them it's real. Make a statement by how you live. Stand up. Protect your walk. And they might just be impressed enough by your stand to inspire them to want to look into it. I remember my dad, we were at my grandmother's, and some kind of family affair, I don't remember what, but he had a religious magazine there, and he was reading. My aunt and uncle weren't into the truth at the time, and he was reading it, and then he laid it down, purposely laid it down, so they could see, you know, the title and so forth, and then walked out, went to town, got something. They picked it up. They became interested. But it didn't just happen because of what they read there. It happened because of who he was. They knew that he lived his faith. And they knew it wasn't phony. So remember, your life may be the only Bible, as they say, that some people ever read. Make sure it's a good one. Make sure it's honorable and respectable. You're an example to others. And that might be the only... You know, people say, well, I can't speak or I can't write. Hey, you can live, right? You can live, and that might be the best evangelism you could ever have. The right kind that lives the faith as it was intended to be. I hope this has helped. May Yahweh bless you.